Hey everyone, this is Byung again. I have a favor to ask. If you've been listening to our podcast and enjoying the insight, wisdom, and stories of our guests, please consider rating us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or liking our episodes on YouTube. And if there's a particular segment you liked or a guest you'd like us to invite or invite back, hit us up on Twitter. Your feedback is what keeps this show going, and we love hearing from you. Thanks again for listening.
We provide a build and test service that at the core is it may look like a CI, but at the core, it has the capability of creating a build dependency graph. And this dependency graph gives us the ability to do many cool things, including speeding up the building and test cycle.
It's not magic, it's science, I guess. So in effect, we analyze builds from the system call level and all the way into a per language level.
Machines are so fast and stores are so big that they give us plenty of latitude to screw things up.
The shell, or which is the name we give to the command interpreter.
So the operator got a pair of tweezers and very carefully fished the moth out of the relay.
Because you all read The Mythical Man Month.
And the best motivator in the world for programming is scratching your itch.
Developers, 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 developers.
Hello and welcome to another installment of the Sourcecraft Podcast. My name is Byung and today I'm chatting with Yves Junqueira and John Ewart, co-founders of Yearbase, a build and test runner application that accelerates your CI by analyzing the build structure so it can intelligently parallelize and cache steps in your build pipeline. We're talking about how their previous experiences as engineers at Google and Amazon have informed their view of DevTools, all the really cool stuff they're doing to speed up builds, and their view of the broader landscape of CI and testing today. Stay tuned. All right, I'm here with Yves Junqueira and John Ewart, two engineers who worked on developer tools at Google and Amazon, now co-founders of Yearbase, a cloud-based build and test service for large, hairy code bases that understands your dependency graph to help your team ship software much faster. Yves and John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Byung. Thank you.
Thanks, Byung.
Yeah, so to kind of kick things off here, I would love to get kind of your developer backstories, you know, how you originally got into programming and what has been kind of the long journey to eventually creating Yearbase.
So I guess for me, I started using computers when I was really little. In fact, my dad brought home one of the first PCs that like Wells Fargo ever had on the day I was born.
Wow.
And he has a background in economics and spent a lot of time tinkering with computers and writing computer models for finance and for banks. And so he got me into programming. I don't know, it was probably 11 or 12. I was doing some Fox Pro programming with him to help out learning how to do some analysis of data. And about that time, Linux was becoming a thing. Computer shows you could pick up CD sets from, you know, Walnut Creek CD-ROM. So I spent a lot of time experimenting with a variety of distributions and FreeBSD and other things. And that kind of started my, I don't know, self-exploratory phase of computing, also known as breaking lots of things, including monitors by setting the refresh rate and the mode set incorrectly. You know, and then I ended up going to college, majored in computer science, went to graduate school, did some work in environmental engineering, worked at a series of small companies and startups, and then ended up being picked up by Amazon about 7 years ago, moving up here to the Seattle area. And then I guess the rest is history from there.
What about you, Yves?
Do you know that movie Hackers from like a 95 movie? 1995 movie. Do you know that?
Yeah.
I wanted to be that. That movie was so good. I fell in love with that movie. I wanted to be a hacker. Like, really, I really wanted to be a hacker. So I heard about this thing called Linux, you know, the internet and whatnot. How do I become a hacker? Oh, you should learn everything about Linux. And I got into that and I got really deep into it. You know, kind of like went into the security bits. I grew up in Brazil, right? And didn't learn coding until much later. I studied like international relations. Eventually couldn't find a job once I was out of the university and ended up going to IT because I had that knowledge from my script kiddie past. And I became a sysadmin and got really good at it somewhat quickly, and I got a job at Google and eventually moved to Zurich in Switzerland, worked there mm-hmm. for many years. So I spent overall 10 years at Google, and then moved to Seattle. And sometime later, I left Google to mm-hmm. to start your base with John. And yeah, that's where we are at now.
Tell me a little bit more about your base. In particular, you know, for people listening who have never heard of it before, how would you describe what it does?
Yeah, sure. We provide a build and test service that at the core is, it may look like a CI, but at the core, it has the capability of creating a build dependency graph. And this dependency graph is... gives us the ability to do many cool things, including speeding up the building and test cycle, and also just providing a lot more information about your testing process and your build process and your software development life cycle. There's a hosted component that you can just use the hosted version of your base, or you can deploy your base servers in your own cloud. And at the end of the day, what you get is this ability to get very fast, high quality feedback on your code and a lot mm-hmm. more intelligence about your build and test process and your dependencies and so forth.
That's really interesting. So, you know, when you mentioned the dependency graph, can you talk to us more about that? So there's many different ways to describe dependencies. Are we talking about, like, you know, it knows node modules and can recompile those interactively, or is it some kind of other notion of dependency?
It's a very broad notion of a dependency, but let me give an example so that makes it a little more clear, right?
Cool.
So let's say that you have a very large application, and let's say that you have a monolith, right, which is a very common pattern for building and shipping software. You have a very large monolith and a lot of people working on that same code base. And it's taking a very long time to test your code base, because once you want to make a change to your software, you want to make sure that there's no regressions when you're checking in changes to the repository. And so you run all these tests and potentially hundreds or thousands of tests. So how do you make sure that you're running the correct tests? Do you run all of the tests that you need? Do you also compile all the dependencies, all the packages that are required underneath? Even if it's not a compiled language, do you have to install all the node modules? Do you have to download all of them? Do you have to re-download all of them every time? So if you look at the build process, in an abstract sense, it's a graph of many nodes, where nodes are different steps. And those steps can be a process that runs on Linux, right? It's just a similar to a make or a CC, the C compiler is running a process that takes some input and it has an output. But mm-hmm. the build and test process is a very large and complex graph of many different activities that could be processes. But sometimes the reason we have a very broad definition of a build and dependency graph is that sometimes your build and test process is actually one Linux process, right? Or one process on the operating system, whatever operating system it is. So in some cases, you just stand up a JVM and you run 1,000 tests on that thing, right? And so we want to know what are the dependencies inside of that thing. So for example, if you really know that module A doesn't depend on module D and you update module D, you probably don't need to run the tests related to module A, because they have nothing to do with each other, right? So understanding these deep dependencies just gives you a lot of power. So for example, you can skip the unnecessary parts of the build and test process, but you can also know what depends on what. You may have accidental dependencies that you don't want, or you may have it may be difficult for you to change some code because you don't know what exactly depends on what and so forth. So the dependency graph is this ability to know very deep what piece of code depends on what.
So how do you construct that dependency graph? You know, am I, as a user of your base, going to have to go through and write a bunch of config files that describes exactly what depends on what, or is there some magic going on here?
No, I mean, so it's not magic, it's science, I guess. So in effect, we analyze builds from the system call level and all the way into a per language level. So if you have, for example, a JVM build, right? You're building a Java program. The JVM, as Eva said, is a single process. You run Maven or whatever you're running, and it's a single execution of a single binary, the Java binary, but it does a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. So we have the ability to monitor from the outside all of the system calls that your build is making. And we use that to figure out what files that you depend on, what, you know, networks you may be calling, all the things that your processes are doing. But we also have the ability with some simple add-ons. So we have, for example, a Maven plugin that when you're building in our CI system, will leverage an external thing that will infer that build graph by analyzing your Java code as it's building. And so then we use both the information from the JVM and also from the process graph to build this dependency graph.
Just to add on what John said, what we don't say, what we keep as a secret, is how do we exactly do that? How do we exactly piece those pieces of the puzzle together? And how do we make it correct? Because the hard bit is how do you actually make sure that this inferred dependency graph is actually correct and corresponds to reality? Because if you get it wrong, and let's say that you're trying to test your code and you accidentally and you incorrectly skip some important part of your build and test process, you're going to get a broken test, right?
That makes sense. I mean, you definitely don't want to trade off speed for or correctness for speed with your builds.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
Got it. But it is kind of your secret sauce right now, but it's if I understand correctly, it's a combination of static analysis and also runtime analysis, like running the build in a sandbox environment where you're kind of observing what syscalls are happening. Is that right?
Yes, syscall and mm-hmm. other things.
And the other addition is the fact that we are able to merge these two, right? We have a blend of both at the system call level where it makes sense and at the programming language level where it makes sense, right? In the case of Java or Ruby, Python, oftentimes you have these, you know, long-running processes that run hundreds, thousands of tests. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, doing the analysis of simply, you know, process-based analysis is not necessarily going to get you much benefit, because the probability that you run your entire RSpec suite based on any code change is probably nearly one, right? And so being able to combine the very fine-grained language-specific details with the externally observed details means that we have a very rich picture of, like, not only what you're running and how you're running it, but what depends on what. And because we have all this data, we can then show you things about your builds. Some of our customers have discovered they're surprised that certain parts of their build have dependencies on some other part of their source code, because of the way they invoked Git or something, for example. And so they've been able to not only automatically, but then to further refine their build process to cut those build times down.
That makes sense. I mean, what you're describing is, it sounds like a really intelligent system. It also sounds like perhaps like the model of using it is quite different from some of the more kind of well-known popular CI and build services. I'm thinking of things like, you know, Jenkins, CircleCI, GitLab CI, GitHub Actions. All these things are, you know, if I want to use them, I'm basically describing exactly what I want to happen in response to, you know, a push or whatever. Like, I'm telling the computer exactly what I want it to run and build. How do you position your base against tools like that? Are you trying to go in and like kind of replace those types of tools, or are you going after a different kind of market altogether?
I think the market is gigantic, so I don't think about replacing tools. And in fact, we are very focused on the build and test bits of it. Mm-hmm. We have a very modular system that can be used with existing CIs. What we have observed, though, is that once a customer deploys your base for their for their systems. If they're using an existing CI, they sometimes think that it's better to not pay twice for something that is providing feedback on their code, right? So they end up because, as you know, hosted CIs at least tend to charge based on parallel execution, like how often are you building and how long it's taking. And if you're delegating to a third party to build it, you're kind of like paying twice. So we made it possible for customers to use our base as a CI that they just integrate directly with GitHub, for example, and then take it from there.
Got it. So you can use your base in conjunction with other build tools and services.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. In fact, we don't focus at all on deployment. I understand that most people talk about CI/CD as being a single entity, right? And yeah. A lot of CI products, CI solutions have also developed pipelines and deployment capabilities. And that's not something that we are focused on. That's not something we're particularly good at. So in fact, that our customers use your base as the entry point CI, and then they do deployment using existing solutions, right? They integrate, we integrate very easily with other solutions. So that's what tends to happen. We focus on the build and test process. We want to do a really good job at that. And we want to be fast, consistent, intelligent, and provide actionable information for folks. No, doesn't matter how big the code base is, and other parts of the problem are better solved by other folks.
That makes a lot of sense. If you were to describe kind of the ideal user of your base right now, do you have kind of a single picture in mind? Is it, you know, a big organization, a small organization, certain languages, certain technologies that are ideal for use with your base?
Yeah, we've evolved over time. So when we started, we sold to very small companies because that's what we could easily support. And over time, we've grown to actually target much significantly larger organizations. And it turns out that the larger organizations are the ones that care the most about efficiency of build and test, because they're the ones that are more likely to have very large code bases that have lots of tests that are very complex, that are hard to manage. And they are the organizations that set up teams dedicated to improving engineering productivity. And mm-hmm. therefore, they see the highest return on investment when they integrate with your base.
I guess, like, kind of taking a step back a bit, you know, you both worked on developer tools at Amazon and Google, which probably have two of the largest proprietary code bases in the world. Can you talk to us about your journey as developers there, with a particular focus on experiences that you had that kind of informed your understanding of the world leading up to creating your base?
Yeah, sure. So I can say that when I initially joined Amazon, my job was working on an internal tool for deployment called Apollo. Apollo is a tool that manages infrastructure, you know, deploys millions of times in a given week to millions of machines. And so that entry point showed me a lot about how automating a lot of the drudgery, I guess, the sort of, building software, deploying it to hosts, by creating a reproducible process mm-hmm. that you could control as a developer that would get out of your way was incredibly powerful. Before joining Amazon, I had worked for a number of small companies and startups. And the one thing that I noticed immediately that was different was coming to Amazon your first day, you know, there's this wiki and you go through it and then someone says, here's a bug, fix it. And at some point during the day or during that first week, you go to click the deploy button and you're kind of shaking because you're thinking, am I going to break the universe, right? But because there are all of these tools in place that help to ensure correctness, to help to deploy things in a repeatable manner, to help roll back all of these things, you can focus on adding value, right? You can focus on building the product that you're building. But at the same time, I will say that, at least at Amazon, there are a lot of the same problems, right? There's the same problems that developers face in the outside world, developers inside of Amazon face. How do I deploy this thing? How do I build this thing? How do I manage the complexity that I'm given, the business model complexity, the program complexity, the dependencies? All of those things are very similar. I think that certainly the size is different between, say, Amazon and Google and, you know, a different small company. Mm-hmm. But I think that at the end of the day, it's really not a giant leap between the two, right? But I think that the one thing that I sort of appreciated the most, and that every time I've come and gone from Amazon a few times. In fact, I think I've been there three different times in the last, you know, 7 years. But every time that I leave, I think, man, if only I had X. And usually it's a thing that simplifies my life such that whenever I look at joining a new project or building a new thing, I don't need to learn an entirely new universe, right? That I simply have a set of tooling that I can run that is repeatable between one team and another, or one project and another. I don't have to remember what version of Ruby is this thing using, or like what, you know, dependency management tool am I using, right? Those kinds of things.
I think that Google is a little weird and different. The life of a Google engineer is, there's a lot of the same struggle. How do I get things done? How do I ship? How do I make this correct? I'm nervous. I don't want to ship this. This is going to break. But Google is different. Google evolved a separate branch of evolution. It's like the I don't know. I was talking to John earlier today about the comb jellyfish. I think it's called. It's an organism that is a little bit like a jellyfish. They are completely different branch of evolution. They have a nervous system, but it was evolved completely independent and different from the nervous system that all the other organisms on Earth have. And the Google engineering feels a little like that. It solves the exact same problems that everything outside solves, but it's like, you put a bunch of engineers like on a vacuum, like isolated on Mars, and now go build this thing that should be exactly like this other thing that Amazon has, right? But make it different. And for a while, and I think that has goods and bads, right? So I think that from that, they evolved very unique approaches to many things, right? From MapReduce to Bigtable to Borg and so
forth. It's like the Australia of developers. That's
a very good analogy. Yes, it's like the Australia of developer infrastructure. And, you know, that's good and bad, right? I think that in general, a team of engineers at Google looks more like another team of engineers at Google than any other team in the world, let's say, right? So So the tooling is very different. Like even programming languages used internally are different. Mm-hmm. Database systems are different. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily better at all. And there are some things that were really good over there and that I still miss today, but that I think over time, the more, I think that it's not so clear to me anymore that the things that Google has are, you know, not in every area. I think that they're better or equivalent alternatives outside, right? I think that Kubernetes is a fantastic ecosystem that is doing much more than Borg does. Mm-hmm. Like SourceGraph has become
Borg would be kind of the internal version of Kubernetes.
Yeah, so correct. Yeah. Yeah, Borg is the internal the thing that came before Kubernetes, right? It's the inspiration for I would say for Kubernetes. The you can't even say that it's container based. It is container based, but that's an implementation detail. Anyway, yeah. So and similarly, there are many other tools that I think outside have become as good or better, and there are many examples, as you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think culture-wise, Amazon has always been more of a there's a bunch of stuff. Let's smash it together and make it work. You know, almost every Java project, the core of the Java build system for a long time and possibly even today was built on Ant, right? So Google's solution, right? Internally, it's called Blaze. Externally, Bazel. Amazon's solution is let's make Ant, you know, work with this standardized build system, or, you know, RSpec working with Rake, right? Their culture is very much take a thing in the wild and bring it in and make it work inside of this wild universe that is Amazon, and not necessarily rebuild a brand new thing all the time. So I think it's, again, it's, I think they're both very similar in scale and engineering talent. And it's just that they have somewhat different approaches to the way that they solve particular problems, right?
But with regards to your original question about how our story is influenced to what we're doing now, I think that the most important thing that I took from Google that definitely influenced the way I've thought about Urbase and we work at Urbase is that I think at Google, there is this insane ambition about what you can do, right, with technology. And there's seemingly no limit about what needs to be done. So the challenge is to define a problem. Once the problem is defined, the rest is just hard work and make it happen. This is true from the very origins of Google, you know, how Google defined this problem. We want to make information available. All the information from the internet available at under 300 milliseconds. It doesn't matter what it takes. And it turns out that what it took was to put all of that in RAM in 1996, right? So it's completely unthinkable. Like no sane person would think about, oh, let's just put the internet in memory, right? In a bunch of computers and go from that. But so that sort of approach where, you know, you don't see the technology is not the end goal, but it's the, you know, just a way to get things done and have, you know, kind of like see no limits to how you do things, definitely like informed our approach. So when I left Google and I was starting a company, and initially Urbase was going to be something else. And I was playing around with many different ideas, including database as a service, you know, microservices platform. I prototyped many different ideas and I tested many different ideas. But the thing that was in common with everything I was doing is that the process of just getting things done and built were just very painful. And I started to talk to many people about, hey, what's your day-to-day like as a developer? And the more people I talked, the more I could see that there was something missing. And I went on and pitched to a bunch of people, hey, what if there was a way for you to get feedback on your code in 5 seconds rather than in 50 minutes? And, you know, and what if it actually built on your laptop rather than actually built on the cloud for your code that as you're writing on your laptop, would you try something like that? And people said, sure, I'll definitely try something like that. I mean, that sounds like a dream. And I would ask, okay, would you like to pay to help development of such solution? And, you know, a bunch of people said yes. And I was like, okay, so I got to build this. And then, you know, I found John, we got together and we spent a ridiculous amount of time actually making this crazy, you know, plan happen because I had no idea how we're going to do this, right? Like, this is a big promise. How do we make sure that we're giving feedback on people, like run all their tests, build their software in the cloud, but make everything seamless and but also make it correct? It was a little bit harder than I thought when we started, and yeah, it took a little bit of time to get to any launchable state. But yeah, it did happen. I'm glad we persisted, and yeah, so I think that persistence, like the goal and the persistence, probably, you know, I probably got a little bit of that from spending time with other folks at Google. Yeah,
that makes sense. I mean, what you're saying, it really sounds familiar to me, because, you know, when we were first starting SourceGraph, it was like, well, there were comparisons to tools inside of Google, you know, code search being the main one for SourceGraph, but there's just so, like, it's so different, you know, inside of Google, the way things work from the outside world, where you're kind of like broadly inspired by the culture there and the prioritization of developer experience and that sort of thing. But then when you go and try to build a solution for everyone else, there's, you know, it's a completely different kind of environment.
Yes.
It is the Wild West.
Yeah. The wild, it's like you're a kangaroo. You've like made it out of Australia. And now you're trying to like hop. I don't know. Maybe that's a bad analogy. Kind of run with the Australia thing there. Yeah.
And then you encounter a platypus.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a simple idea on paper, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, out of curiosity, do you find that when you're talking to potential customers or users, do you see a correlation between like having worked at Google or Amazon or an organization like that earlier in their career and being able to just like grok what your base does? Or is it kind of, you know, uncorrelated with that?
It is easier. Absolutely. So, you know, there's a large contingent of former Google, Facebook, Amazon engineers, and they come to expect some things from their developer tools. And when we go and talk to them, we don't have to explain much, right? So that definitely makes the conversation easier. But what we found is that that's not necessarily a requirement to have good, successful customer conversations. As you know, these days, large organizations have dedicated areas, departments, teams for doing engineering productivity. And those people leading those teams know everything that's going on, right? They know what is the state of the art. They know the latest trends, the best tools. Their challenge is to make things happen that work for their organization, right? So when they have the problem that we help solve, when they have the problems that we help solve, it's a somewhat easier conversation. And in fact, I'm not sure that your audience our audience here cares too much about these bits, but in fact, we actually found out that we have a much better time talking to those leads on engineering productivity teams than to an individual developer. And I'm not sure, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if you've observed the same, but even though the developer may have that pain of like waiting for 30 minutes for their build, maybe they just don't imagine that that's something that can be improved.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just, or maybe the build is such a hairy part of the development process. Nobody wants to be associated with it. Nobody wants to change it. Nobody wants to deal with it, unless for that crazy person that, you know, that maintains the build. Every team has that person, right? So people don't think that it's possible to iterate and improve their process, right? So that's why we have much easier conversations with more experienced people, like very senior architects and so forth. And I think they embrace change. To my surprise, they embrace change a little easier than I would expect.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like the most developers, it's not their job to think about build speeds and that sort of thing. So even though they feel the pain, it might not be at the forefront of their minds. Like, hey, I could actually, you know, step up and bring in a solution that changes this for my team. Whereas if you're talking to someone who works on the developer productivity team, it's like, that's their job description, make the team more productive. And so they kind of see more of the instant value of your product, and they actually have the will to kind of push forward adoption of it.
Yeah. But I can tell you that, you know, we have some customers where their builds used to take 20 minutes plus easily every time. You know, and this is a group of folks that builds a lot, you know, hundreds of times per week easily. And normal build times with us are, you know, 4 or 5 minutes on average. Yeah. But when they start creeping up to 8 or 9 minutes, you know, the alarm bells start ringing, right? So once you get used to that, you kind of, you know, you don't want to give it up.
Yeah, it's hard to go back to the the bad old boy.
Yep.
And that's kind of how I felt, you know, coming from Amazon is internally, you want to start a new project. You'd go to this neat tool and you'd say, I want to build a Java project. I want to use these frameworks. You'd click a button. It would make you a source repository. It would be pre-populated with basically a skeleton project that would build right out of the gate. It would be, you know, you'd say, I want to deploy it to XYZ, and it would provision some capacity and infrastructure. And you just clone the source code onto your machine, make some changes, build, push, and off it goes. Mm-hmm. Whereas now every time I think about building a new thing, I feel like, oh man, now I have to go do X, Y, Z, and then don't forget this thing, right? And so I would love to help push the ball forward to a world where for all developers, it's as easy as that. And the feedback loop is such that you can get feedback immediately, right? There's no long wait cycle between, you know, doing a build, seeing the results, pushing a pull request, finding out that it's passed, all those parts of the build process.
Yeah, it's almost like you're trying to eliminate that build anxiety.
Yeah, the my code's compiling meme, right? The XKCD comic.
Yeah.
You know, those guys will be grumpy because they won't have sword fighting anymore.
So you mentioned Blaze as a, you know, Blaze is Google's internal build system, now open sourced as Bazel. Bazel, is it Bazel?
Bazel, yep.
Bazel, got it. So Blaze and Bazel, that's how Google builds things internally. And since it's open sourcing, do you see that affecting kind of the landscape of CI and builds? What do you think the impact of that is going to be on the world?
Well, I hope it affects, and I think that it is seeing very good adoption in many places. Yeah. I think that it's, I used it for many years. It's a fantastic system. It's definitely a major evolution to many things that are available out there. And mm-hmm. I think that people should definitely take a look at Bazel and learn about it and understand it. It's very robust, very mature. It's very fast. It's just a different way of thinking about build, and it's a different way of writing your tests and programming your entire application to be compiled, build, and so forth. So when I left Google, I immediately, fortunately, Bazel was already open sourced, so I jumped right on the bandwagon, and I started using Bazel too. What was interesting for me was that the experience at the time of using Bazel was very different. At Google, mm-hmm. everything is already much similar to what John described it at Amazon. At Google, everything's already set up, right? You just come in, you type your username and password, and you have access to build Google search, right? And yep. kind of oversimplifying a little bit, but everything is already set up for you. Everything is there. With Bazel, that was not the case, and I had trouble adding dependencies to my projects. The as you probably know, with Bazel, the challenge is that it really needs to understand very deeply. It needs to know everything about your project, all the way to all dependencies, all the way down. You really have to declare to use Bazel to build all your dependencies. And this is a challenge because anytime you want to use a third-party software, and that software has its own rules for building itself, which is the case for the larger, slightly more complex projects, then you have to write the compilation rules and the testing rules and so forth by yourself. And you have to adapt their build system and sometimes even the code because of different import paths and whatnot. And you have to adapt all of that to your scenario, right? In order to work with your code. I think that there's a possibility that over time, if a very large contingent of people uses Bazel, right, and there's widespread usage of Bazel, just like there is for Kubernetes, let's say, and suddenly it becomes a standard, not suddenly, but like if it becomes a standard, if it passes a certain critical threshold where there's enough momentum in the community where almost every open source project has a way to be built automatically by Bazel, or if the Bazel team invests a lot on automatic ways of building things, I can mm-hmm. see it becoming even more popular, which is, you know, very exciting. I think that it's a tool that is really great. But at least for now, what we see is that there are many companies that have the problems that Bazel solves, including incremental builds, mm-hmm. Which you know, gives you this ability to have the way that Bazel works very quickly is that it allows you to build and test software incrementally because it compiles and it executes steps on its graph, and it caches them in a distributed way. So if you have different people working on the same code base and you build a certain part of the code and someone else builds the exact same code that has the same exact file contents, it's able to reuse parts of that step. You know, it just fetches that from a distributed cache and it can speed up some things, which is great.
But you kind of have to specify that in advance.
But right? You have to specify all of that in advance. So for large companies that have been moving to Bazel or are using Bazel, many of them are very successful. They're talking about it outside, but it's a low and hard-nosed process, right? And I'm really looking forward to what Google is continuing to do with Bazel. What we are doing is, you know, we have a different approach. I think that if you're using Bazel or using any other system, what we do is we do two things. First, we just assume that your build system is not going to change significantly internally. So whatever tool you're using, Maven, Gradle, Bazel, or just make files or whatever you're using, you don't have to change that. You don't have to throw it away. It's just too much work to do that for a very large code base. It's almost impossible. So we take that and we try to augment it and instrument it so that it's able to use the dependency graph that we provide, you know, as an API, and automatically able, and then you're able to speed, you know, have incremental builds and have incremental testing. That's something that Bazel doesn't do, that we found out that we also had to do in order to deliver on that crazy, you know, goal that we had of like, oh, like we're going to build your software. It's easy. We're just going to build your software much faster than you normally do. And it turns out that we also had to do something called test selection, which is you need to test that this particular test depends on this other code. So therefore, when you're changing this other code, you need to run this test, right? And this happens. That's not something that Bazel is able to do because Bazel works only at the package level granularity. And it doesn't go very deep on let's say it has a coarser grained dependency graph, and we have a finer grained dependency graph. So we're pretty much an addition. We don't replace Bazel. Like, I think that what we see is that a company that is considering using Bazel, they are going for the incremental build aspect. Mm-hmm. And they can do that with Bazel. And the advantage of Bazel is that it's a very robust, very mature system. Awesome. And it's provably correct because it's very conservative. And yep. Our approach is we focus on reliability also and speed. But our differentiator is convenience, right? You don't have to write a dependency graph. You don't have to specify things. And our system does that for you. So you can get some of the same benefits that you would get from Bazel, but a lot of the benefits that you get from Bazel, but with a lot more, it's a lot more convenient.
That makes sense. It's not like either or either, right? Like your approach is like whatever you use as your build system, whether it's Bazel or, you know, Ant or Maven, like your base takes that and kind of understands the dependency graph with the configuration that's available and actually executes that build in an efficient manner.
Yep.
Yeah.
Got it. Just out of curiosity, do you use Bazel at all internally for your own source code?
We initially did. It was not a very popular thing within the team. I really wanted to continue using it. And we at the time, this was, it was at the very beginning of the project. Joan, I think, was not even getting started yet when I switched off Basil, and then we started using our own, like we created a, you know, your base supports a very simple declarative syntax for specifying build, much like any traditional CI. Mm-hmm. And you, so we created that instead. And that's something that John was very keen on creating, because it's very, you know, it's the modern way of developing, of defining your build and test, right? You just like a, you know, SQL CI, you would specify a YAML and so forth. So we created something similar. So internally we use that same system. We use our own build declarative syntax.
Okay, got it. So you're just using kind of your own.
Yeah, and yeah. So what we're able to do is we're able to, like, your base is able to understand the different components within your repository, right? Mm-hmm. And it's able to glue together different repositories. So that's how we were able to not need Basil at the end of the day.
Can I get your comment on the kind of Basil lookalikes out there now? I mean, there's several build systems that are kind of have the same high level vision. You know, things that come to mind: Buck out of Facebook, Pants, Gradle, Please.build. Mm-hmm. What's your familiarity with those tools, and, you know, how do you view them in the kind of broader CI landscape?
I haven't used them in any active project. I did research them, and I'm optimistic about all these graph-based build systems. And I think that it's a really robust, really good way to develop code. But I think it's a different style, and I think that people are going to land on a graph-based build system or not, and it's going to depend on their requirements. I think that in my experience, what succeeds is what the developers want to adopt, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that my guess is that people prefer a simpler approach where it's a little bit closer to what a Docker file is, where things are very, very simple to define. You just run commands on a container, and, mm-hmm. you know, that's the end of the story. And that's, you know, yeah, I think that that's a little bit more intuitive and simpler for developers, because it matches with their own experience when they're developing on their laptop, right? While these other systems have a learning curve. But I think that developer infrastructure, developer tools, there's, you know, users for everyone. I think that this is a gigantic, to speak in, you know, CEO fashion here, there's a gigantic market here. So I don't think, like, anyone should feel defensive about this or that. I think there's, you know, as long as we're solving a problem for people that want the thing in a particular way or that have the particular type of requirement, I think that there's space for everything. But my current, what we see from our customers, at least, is that people tend to gravitate towards the simpler way of, like, a little bit more container-based, like commands on the Linux container sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. You know, as you look towards the future, do you have any predictions about how the CI landscape is going to evolve? You know, like 5 years from now, are most people going to be using Basil? Is your base going to be kind of the kind of standard default build system for both large companies, open? Like, if you were to, you know, get on kind of the Nostradamus soapbox, you know, predict the future for us, please.
Yeah, of course. It's easy. I think that to predict the future, you have to think about what is the arrows of evolution pointing towards, right? What are the evolutionary pressures on these systems? And I think what is guaranteed to continue to happen is that we're going to have more languages, we're going to have more versions, we're going to have more open source, we're going to have more types of technologies, we're going to have AI-driven development, right? We're going to have all sorts of things happening everywhere. And so there's more fragmentation. So that's in the developer tools landscape. Mm-hmm. But there's, so I think that there's, it's very hard to say that this model is going to win or that model is going to win. I think that if I could bet, I think it's going to be like in any most other technology like this. I think the closest analogous is like databases, right? There's just not a single database. There is a handful of extremely popular databases. There are databases like Oracle that have been around for a long time. So I don't think, for example, that Jenkins is going to go away. I don't think Makefiles are going to go away ever, right? And I think mm-hmm. that established CIs are going to be here for a long time. But I think that new use cases and new needs are going to push for the growth of certain models. And what I hope to, and I hope that I'm right, is that what we're setting up, you know, our company to try to be is we're there for handling complexity really well. And I think that complexity is this thing that is going to grow a lot over time, all the time, you know, nonstop, right? And I think that if you want a specialized build system that is able to handle complex needs or is able to scale from a small application all the way to, you know, I'm Facebook complexity, I think that your base is going to be your system of choice. But like in everything, there's going to be a second system of choice. You know, there's going to be Bazel. And I think that there's a lot of people using Bazel with your base, and we're going to have an amazing integration with Bazel for Bazel customers. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I think that's what I'd love to be at. You know, we're in this future where your base is the choice for very serious software feedback on when you're trying to ship code fast.
I guess, you know, just taking a step back for a second from kind of a, you know, maybe a first principles perspective, why do you think build systems are so, you know, hard and complex? You know, you're telling like a developer in like 1980, you know, they'd probably be like, well, you have your source code, you have your deployment target, you got the compiler, you know, how many ways are there to skin that cat, you know?
But I think that John is better to answer the. I just wanted to make a comment. I think that if we knew how hard it is, maybe we would have chosen something else to do, right? Because it took a long time to get to a good state. But I'll let John answer that because I think we know, you know, very very painful ways what it took us to get to this point.
Yeah, you're right. There, I think the primary challenge with all build systems is that it is a very open-ended problem, right? You are trying to solve effectively a problem that has an unlimited problem space because the number of permutations of language, build tool, like, you know, Rake, for example, consider Java, right? You've got Ant, you've got Maven, you've got Gradle, you've got, if you're running Clojure, you've got Linen, I forget the name of it. But like within that small single language JVM space, you have 5-10 different tools that you could use to build your particular package. And so attempting to encompass all of that is very challenging, right? Trying to predict all of the things that people are going to do and going to want to do with your system and your tooling. And we all do this, right? The ways in which we break those systems is pretty impressive. And so I think the biggest thing is building a tool that is flexible enough that can evolve with people's needs and that it can grow with the ecosystem, but providing enough structure and scaffolding such that it is not, to your point about, you know, Australia, that it is not the Wild West, you know. So I think that there's a middle ground, and I think for a very long time, we've ended up rebuilding systems that are very tailored to like a specific niche, right? And on top of it all, you've got now you've got multiple services, right? Your build and test for what seems to be a fairly simple API involves, your Flask application, if it's maybe written in Python, and maybe you've got a Redis cache and you've got Postgres, and then you've got, some mail service, and Lord only knows, you've got full text search. You've got all of these things that are running. And so being able to model all of those things is very hard. But I think that from a user's perspective, the thing that is really hard about build systems is just that. It's the, how do I keep all of this in my brain when I hop from project A to project B? When I move from, even for me, for a very long time, I have, like most developers, tons of unfinished projects sitting on my computer, right? We all do, right? And I say to myself, I really want to add feature X to this thing. So I'll open up a terminal, hop in, and I'll just be like, okay, wait, Control R, search through my history. How did I build this thing? What tools did I need to download? Oh, that was a different computer, And so, and on top of it all, then when you go from local development to, your CI system to your deployments, you oftentimes have totally different tooling. So you have this configuration drift between how I build my stuff as a new developer, how I build my source code and run my tests inside of an automated system, how I, package it and release it. And, my hope is that I'd love to build tooling that basically takes all of that complexity and sort of narrows down the number of things that you need to remember in order to, be up and running. So now, at least when I work on a new project, I just hop in and I say, YB build. I don't have to remember, oh, this requires Python and a virtual environment, right? That's automatically taken care of for me. And so the other thing is that you get that feedback, right? Being able to build it in the CI system or in your automated system as part of your full process is the exact same as being local, right? You don't have this works on my machine type response, right? I'm sure you've all seen the image, like stamp works on my machine, good to go. So it's a very complicated and it's always changing. It's an always evolving landscape, and it is basically completely open-ended. There's almost no way to enumerate every single combination that people will come up with.
Yeah. It's almost like that complexity. It's almost like a creeping vine. It sneaks up on you, it slowly grows over time. And when you're writing code, like the build system is never the thing, right? Like the thing is the actual application. And so it's kind of an afterthought, and you keep tacking on these. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, at some point you just like take a step back and like, whoa, like when did this come into existence?
Yeah. Yes. To quote, Frankenstein's creator, right? I've created a monster.
And I actually love, like earlier you mentioned that, some of your customers are using your tool to actually discover dependency links that they didn't even know about before. And that's almost like you've gone beyond just like making the build faster. You're actually helping people understand what the like actual links are in their chain. Cause it's kind of easy to forget what those are over time. Like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. Like that thing affects this thing.
Yeah. In fact, this is one of the surprises when we started, selling our product. Hey, here's this thing that we built. What do you think of it? Right. That's basically, we went very humbly to these gigantic, amazing companies that we were trying to sell this thing. And we think that it's useful for increasing build time, for reducing build time. Right. And then, people started to look at this and, can you give me an API for this? Because I have some ideas. Right. And then we started to figure out that, actually you can track test flakiness if you actually know your test results and you know how they're evolving over time and which test depends on which code and if you know what libraries you depend upon, if you know where your library came from, that's probably good for security. So it like we're finding like interesting applications about the dependency graph that we didn't think about, like finding the surprise dependencies was an early find that was very interesting. The more we get deployed on more complex infrastructures, I think that our approach now is to not try to guess what people what our system is useful for, right? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we understand that this is an important problem. Software is complex, and you need to understand the relationship between different pieces of code and how your code is built and how you see that your code is working. That's mm-hmm. like what we do really well is like we understand this, right? And here's information, and we make it possible for people to figure that out, and then we give them APIs and we give them ways to like take that, right, and take it and run with it. So one of those surprise evolutions that I think lots of companies, and I know that this also happened for SourceGraph, that one of those things that people use your system in unexpected, amazing ways. That's, for an entrepreneur is really nice to see, right? Because you actually provided more value than what you thought you were going to be able to.
Yeah. Users will always surprise you, right? I read an article recently from a person who was basically a sales rep at a startup, and they were selling some sort of database product, and I forget the name of it offhand. Mm-hmm. But they were having a hard time selling it. I think it was a woman. They would follow up with customers to find out, oh, hey, you downloaded our product. How's it going? And a lot of customers would say, I haven't used that product. I don't remember that. And they said, yeah, you downloaded it. You paid us $20. Oh, oh yeah. It was pretty neat, but it didn't solve my problems. But the story was such that they encountered one customer who was super excited, and they loved the product. They said, this is the best thing. We have this use case where, it was a database product, and we would send, I guess, sales reps into the field, and they would be gathering information, and they had been using all sorts of, CSVs and Excel files and whatever else, and then trying to merge it back together. Mm-hmm. But apparently, because this database was so small and embeddable, they put it into a little program. And so all of their sales reps out in the field could, record all their information and bring it back and merge it. And the salesperson was like, I never even thought of it. Like, we never had thought about using it that way. And there were a couple of times where that became a repeat pattern. And then that became their product. They just went off in this direction of, this is what we're building, right? Because that's what resonated so well with the users. So it's always fun to see how people use your tools and your product in ways that delight them and are very surprising to you, right? I'm sure SourceGraph has similar stories as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, actually, seeing as we're almost out of time now, second to last question for both of you. If there's someone listening out there right now who's working inside a Google or an Amazon or, just any development organization, and there's some tool or there's some part of the developer experience that they see in that organization that they want to bring to the rest of the world, what advice would you give to that person?
That's a good question. I think that it depends on what. First thing is talk to people before you assume that the thing that is used internally is going to be needed outside. That's one of John's mantras, right? That like most people don't actually have Amazon's problems, right? So I think that that's mm-hmm. An interesting thing to keep in mind. I think that if you have that energy, that information, that insight about something that you think other people will find useful, and you want to either start your own company or have let's say an open source project from within the existing company where you want to open source that project and get it to the hands of more people. I think the most important advice that I would have liked to hear earlier on my career is that the most important thing that engineers should be doing to really make their work successful is to actually go and understand users, go talk to users. Mm-hmm. And really, really figure out that if the problem that you want to solve is a problem that they have, and maybe invert the equation a little bit and ask what are their problems and go from there so that you don't waste time packaging your internal project into an open source that is not super useful. Because maybe you learn that if you make small changes and you launch it with a different messaging, or if you launch it with a different deployment model, you get more success. Or maybe it's okay for your company to ship that as a service instead of an open source software. And for people that are thinking about starting companies, it's very useful to reach out to other founders. I definitely talked to Byung and Quinn very early on to like, hey, what is this stake? What is this thing starting a company? How do I do that, right? And I think that it's incredibly useful to, if you're thinking about starting a company, reach out to other founders. They have scars that, you know, they want other founders to not have the same scars. And there are many problems you can anticipate if you're thinking about that. My last point is that in general, I think it's a really good idea in general. When you see that there's a thing that is used internally that you think could be used outside, that is a very good pattern. I think that I don't think that's a bad pattern at all. And I think because you've seen that case and maybe your company is a little bit further in the future than other companies, and you think that other companies are like the outside world is going to catch up. So that's a good pattern. So you should definitely look into that.
I think similar to that, my perspective is also don't wait to get feedback. Make sure that I think one of the things that we've learned is nothing is perfect. It's okay to start getting feedback from people, and you need to get it earlier on before you've gone too far off of the rails. Right. So I think getting that feedback from users is critical. I also think that, in very much echoing Evis's point, that going out and finding people who have the same problem and getting to understand where they're coming from. And then also, once you do launch it, don't necessarily be tied to it ending up a certain way, right? It will evolve on its own in a lot of ways. And I think that it's important to embrace that. You know, not to like chase every little thing all of the time, but to follow the trend, right? If people start using a particular part of the product the most, right? I think that you should listen to your customers and your users. Because at the end of the day, you know, that's who we service is the people that are using our tooling. And our goal is to make them to be happy developers, right? Making their lives better. And so I think definitely getting out there and getting people's reactions, getting people to use it is very critical.
So my final question is, if someone's listening to this and is interested in trying out Yourbase, how can they get started?
Yeah, I think the best way is for them to go to yourbase.io to learn more and follow the steps from there. We would be very excited to hear what they think. We are on Twitter too, so reach out and let us know what they think.
Well, my guests today have been Evis Junqueira and John Ewart. Evis and John, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Byung. It was great.
Yeah, thanks. It was a real pleasure.
The Sourcegraph podcast is a production of Sourcegraph, the universal code search engine, which gives you fast and expressive search over the world of code you care about. Sourcegraph also provides code navigation abilities like jump to dev and references in code review and integrates seamlessly with your code host, whether you're working in open source or on a big, hairy enterprise code base. To learn more, visit sourcegraph.com. See you next time.